Hey everybody, this is George, your host of Gaming My Whole Life. Today, once again, we have the lovely Jamel joining us. Jamel, how you doing?
I'm doing great, George. How about yourself?
I am doing great. Thanks for asking, my friend. And once again, we have the return of Jay. Jay, welcome aboard.
Thanks, boys. Pleasure to be here with such a great lifelong friend here. It's an honour.
It helps, especially when you're talking about gaming. The history plays its part. Now, today's topic, we have two of them. The first, which is something we've mentioned briefly on the show, but we've never really spoken about it in depth, and that is the survival horror genre. Now, I think the best way to start this off is to just quickly explain the difference between a horror game and a survival horror game, because there is actually a difference. So, horror is, you think of games like Amnesia, or Slenderman, or Alien Isolation. They are games which there is some sort of threat around you, and it's generally a spooky environment, and you're uncomfortable. But you have very little tools to defend yourself. So you spend the majority of the time hiding under chairs, running for your life, you know, you're powerless fantasy. Survival horror, that though, is different. That's, yes, you have your scares and so forth, but to some extent, you can defend yourself. You will, for example, the old Resident Evil games and the most recent, The Evil Within, they are survival horror games because A, you have scares and you're just generally in a, scary environment. And B, you do get guns, you do get ammunition, but you don't get enough where it becomes an action game. You will think twice before shooting because you want to conserve that ammo because you never know what's around the corner. Now, this is a hard genre to pull off. If you add too many monsters and too much action elements, it becomes an action game and people rebel. And old Resident Evil fans would understand this, as many of them have not enjoyed the entries that much after 4, so Resident Evil 5 and Resident Evil 6, just because they lent more on, well, action, you know, and then survival horror just loses that scary factor. So I want to discuss this with both of these respected gentlemen, and just really get down to the nitty-gritty, what actually makes a survival horror game, what makes it so enjoyable, and why would we voluntarily play a game that scares us? Like, it seems like a strange thing, you know, you're actually part of the horror, and we love it. Are we psychopaths? Possibly, but that's probably something we can speak to our doctors about. And Jay, I'll start with you right off the bat, and then we'll go to Jamel. Tell us about your survival horror experience, or just why you think it is a special genre, or what it is to you.
Yeah, George, I think you touched on it pretty well. I think the difference between, you know, a game where ammo is in abundance and you're not scared to pull the trigger on your weapon to fire them off is, you know, it's something that when you don't have that and you're really conservative and you really got to, like, you know, keep tabs on what you have, I guess makes it a bit more real to me. And you know, I think that's why I was massive on the early Resident Evil games and do love them. So yeah, I think that I guess it's more realistic is the probably only way I can sort of explain it. But I mean, touching on your psychopath comments, I think I'm probably more in that category. My brothers and I just have a thrill of just scaring each other. So whether that be just hiding behind a door and popping out and scaring each other or whatnot, so maybe it's ingrained in me from an early age. So I'm not really sure, but yeah, I guess the realism is what I'd probably put it down to.
Okay, well, what do you mean by realism? Are you saying there's more attention to detail in survival horrors, or could you clarify that just a little bit?
Yeah, sorry, mate. I guess, like, if you know, you put yourself in that situation, you're not going to always have an abundance of ammunition in your guns. I guess if you're real, if it was a sort of a real scenario, you're not going to be able to have 1,000 shotgun shells carrying around, like, you know, or some other games. Yeah, sorry, that's what I mean. Like, you know, you're sort of what you can actually carry, and, you know, if you were in that situation, then you would be searching, you would be scavenging, you would be crafting things together to try and get through. So I guess that's the way my mind sort of works.
That's a brilliant take. Like, I've never considered it like that, but you're absolutely right. Survival horror is more realistic in that aspect.
I mean, because, besides the zombies, but yeah. So you never know.
Despite the zombies and the fact you still magically heal yourself with, you know,
wrapping bandages.
Or first aid sprays or, like, herbs.
Exactly. Well, herbs, to be honest, is pretty realistic if you think about traditional medicine.
Maybe not so.
But I don't think it's as fast and effective as some games would like you to believe. Okay.
Yes.
Jamel, how do you feel about survival horror? And if you're not a big fan on it, what can you appreciate about it?
Okay. I am actually a huge fan of survival horror because, like the both of you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like the both of you, I remember when survival horror started with Resident Evil, because until that game came out, there was no survival horror game. I've spoken about this before, so I'm going to move away from Resident Evil for a second. But just that feeling of when you start that game, you have no idea what's going on. You have, you know, until you encounter the first enemy, you more or less don't know what it is. I mean, the modern age has changed that a bit, you know, with, like, reviews and, like, videos and stuff like that. But in 1996, I think it was, when Resident Evil came out, there was none of that. You had no idea. Tension...
Very different time.
And the limited item space that Jay was talking about, that creates its own tension. Because you're sitting there going, like, I have to try to prepare for everything I'm trying to do. I have to try to anticipate. But I have to carry this, you know... item number A to get through puzzle number X. So you're sitting there constantly doing that calculation in your head, you know, and then you run into those situations of, like, when you play the game the first time, you know, you do start drilling everything, and then you're like, there's no more bullets.
I made a mistake.
Yes.
Can you explain what you mean by... what you mean by item management? Because younger listeners wouldn't actually be familiar with that because it's not really existence in this day of age. What is item management in those old survival horror games? Like, what does it even mean?
Well, in Resident Evil 6... Mm-hmm. In Resident Evil 1, I beg your pardon, you only had six items. You had six item slots unless you were playing the easy mode. And even then, you only had eight.
So you could only carry a certain amount or something.
Yeah. So you had eight boxes or six boxes, and then a gun was one box. Your ammo was another box. Puzzle items were another box. Healing items were another box. So by the time you did everything, you were like, oh, but what if I have to pick something up? You know? Yeah. And then so many people had to, you know... just die and rinse and repeat and rinse and repeat until they understood what was going on. Another great game like this was Dino Crisis, also a Capcom game, because in Dino Crisis you didn't have a nice little handy HUD that told you if you were hurt or not. You had to look at your character and go, oh geez, Regina looks a bit busted up, I should probably heal her.
that's a smart design. It's like, have you always walked with a limp?
And in Dino Crisis, you were fighting dinosaurs, and if a dinosaur slashed you and you were bleeding, you had to, like, find a hemostat to stop the bleeding, or you would just bleed to death.
Oh, wow, that's quite realistic.
Yeah, it was really good.
Oh, nice. I had completely forgotten about Dino Crisis. Unfortunately, that's a dead series. I think they stopped after Dino Crisis 2. Correct me if I'm wrong. Dino Crisis 2 was awesome, but I don't recall hearing a Dino Crisis 3.
I think you're right.
Yeah,
I'll all right. Okay, I'm right. Well, go ahead, mate.
Oh, I was going to ask, in your minds, what are the elements of a good survival horror game?
All right, look, I'll give this a crack since I haven't shared my opinion yet. I think the good elements of a survival horror game is those which makes you pay attention and treat the game, as Jay said, as if you were there in person. Like, you react not as a gamer would, but how you would in that environment. So, say you've encountered, you know, a very dangerous enemy, and you manage to kill it, and, you know, in a game, you'd be like, yep, I killed him, threat's over, and just, you know, blast bullets everywhere on the smaller enemies. But in real life, you know, provided there is actually monsters, you'd be terrified, and you'd think, hang on, what if there's another one of these? Maybe I should hold on to this. And you'd be a lot more aware of noises around you. Like, if you hear a creak, it's like, what's that? So, if a survival horror game makes me take everything in consideration, what I'm looking at, what I'm hearing, past experiences, and I'm still nervous, but I don't feel powerless, though. Like, I have some weapons on me. I've fought really hard to hold on to those extra bullets. So I feel I can probably take on what's ahead, but I can probably only take down one super beast. So for me, it's that fear factor and balance in it, because you don't want to feel continuously uncomfortable while playing a game, because obviously you need to have some enjoyment. And for me, that break, and I'll use Resident Evil as that example just because it's the first one that pops in my head and my favorite survival horror genre, a game series, is when you'd go to those save rooms and you'd have the typewriter. So for those who don't know, you would actually save your progress on the typewriter. But here's the catch. To save your progress on the typewriter, you would need to use an ink cartridge, and you only had a certain amount. Now, even though I did like the ink cartridge system, because I like to save as much as, you know, I need to, because maybe I'll regret, you know, using those 4 or 5 bullets earlier on, I did like the fact that every time you discovered these rooms, it was the only place within the whole game which you could guarantee you would not get hurt. Like, the music would change, you would have relaxing piano music, and it was like, oh, it was the one and only breather. So sometimes during more intenseful moments, I'm like, oh, I need a save point, I haven't reached it in a while, I hate this. It's like, I'm terrified. If I lose, I'm going to lose hours of progress. And then I'll find one of these rooms, and I'll literally, like, I won't even save for a bit. I'll just, like, stand there and listen to the music. And it was the equivalent of... See, I didn't know my fireplace fetish yet.
In the beginning.
So, you know, that was my first any gaming fetish. Like, it was just listening to that piano, and I'm like, oh, I am safe. And just like I was staring at a fireplace in every other game to this day, I just stand there and be like, yes, I am home. So, yeah, if anything I just said made sense, that's what makes a survival horror game to me. Jay, did you want to add anything to Jamil's question before we move on to the next topic?
Yeah, look, I think I agree with you, George. I think, like, if the game's immersive enough where you're literally looking at every inch of the screen because you're searching for resources or clues or puzzle pieces, and you're that immersed by what you're watching and what you're hearing, you're listening for, you know, your surroundings, whether it be, look, oh, great, there's no noise, or, yep, I can hear stuff, so things are closer, that just really amplifies that fear factor you were speaking of. And then when those pop-up or pop-out enemies come and, you know, just, really give you a good, nice fright, I think that's the kind of elements I look for in the real immersive, yeah, survival horror. So.
Nice. All right, so the next topic, and we'll probably focus on this one a bit because I do find it super interesting, is there's been a lot of rumors going about the upcoming PlayStation 5. And there's been a few apparent leaks. How true they are, who knows, take it with a grain of salt. But like anything, all rumors originate from something. And a lot of these rumors do seem plausible. So I thought I'd bring these rumors to your ears. And you can let me know if you reckon it's just a bunch of gibberish, or if there's something there. And more importantly, if you think this actually sounds pretty cool. So the reason why we're even having this conversation is apparently Sony have already started sending out dev kits to developers, as of this day. I say as of this day, I mean like some at some point this week. They apparently sent out the dev kits or sooner. And this is a sign that obviously if they're in a position where they can send out dev kits, then that means the launch must not be too far off. And a lot of people are speculating that they doubt it would launch this year, just because the PlayStation 4 Pro hasn't been out that long, and consumers who bought that console would feel a little bit ripped off if, you know, they invested in this product that Sony's like, get this for your ultimate 4K experience, and then only 1 or 2 years later, they've already released the follow-up console. Like, you'd feel a little bit jibbed. So many are expecting that you know, the console should most likely launch end of 2019. We could all be wrong and it could come out at the end of this year, which I think would be a huge mistake. But yeah, that's what caused the rumors. Now, some more specifics have come out about it, and that is apparently this is going to be a beast of a machine. Like, the sort of gaming console which wouldn't beat the current high-end PCs, but it wouldn't be that far off either. Like, at the moment, high-end PCs just laugh at consoles. Like, it's just too far ahead, you know? Whereas that gap is apparently going to be breached. And, yeah, you know, PC games won't have to be downgraded so much just to work on the console counterpart. And the main selling point of this, like, it shouldn't come as any surprise to anyone that the PlayStation 5 would naturally be stronger than the PlayStation 4. But what the interesting thing is that apparently Sony has chosen to focus heavily on their virtual reality involvement. And somehow, it's apparently baked into the system. Now, we don't exactly know what that means, but basically, it's meant to make VR easier on the PlayStation 5. So at the moment on the PlayStation 4, you have the VR headset. I believe you can get a separate PlayStation camera thing for tracking movement, and you have those motion control cone things, you know, which I think started on the PlayStation 3. Anyway, long story short, you have a bunch of wires everywhere, and it's a little bit of a headache. So apparently, it'll be a lot more user-friendly, a lot more approachable, and I personally speculate that the reason why this system will be so beefy is because VR makes a lot of people nauseous. If there's the slightest delay between your head tracking movement and what you see on screen. So it has to hold a constant 60 frames per second. Anything less, and you know, it does a little bit of a weird thing to your brain where you've turned your head and the screen hasn't exactly kept up the expected way your brain was predicting, and it causes nausea. So yeah, has to be strong. Anyways, this is all we know at the moment with all this information. Jamil, I'll start with you. What do you think about the PlayStation 5, like the potential of it, what you would like to see from it? And if nothing that's been said catches your interest, what good do you think can still come from it, nevertheless, from a gaming consumer perspective?
Oh, everything you said catches my interest, because having things about the VR inbuilt, because I just think that's where the future is with a lot of this gaming stuff.
You do love VR. You've mentioned it quite a few times.
It's just so immersive, and it is just the next level of gaming experience. Yeah, if it's a game that's good enough to catch you and get you into the experience, it's some of the best fun I've had. And I've only played it a couple of times. I think it's genius having the I reckon it's just going to be like the hardware part of the VR that's going to be inbuilt into the console, and you'll have either some sort of wireless connection or Bluetooth or something like that, or just like a simple cord that goes from the PlayStation to your little doohickey that you put in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Then it'll make it, you know, if it's only the one cable, then that's going to be a lot easier. And I think it's brilliant because VR will bring anyone in. You could get your mum to have VR a try, and she'll be like, oh my god, this is awesome. Because it's a relatable experience. It's not a controller. It's a, you know, something that's relative to their day-to-day stuff. So they're going to get a really high install base with something like that, I think. And it also reminds me of the original release of the PlayStation 3. You know how the original release had like all this stuff in it, and then over time they released versions that were cheaper that had less features?
Yep, yep.
It reminds me of that, and that original PlayStation 3 was such good value. It was ridiculous.
Okay. I actually hadn't considered it like that. I personally, before you said what you said, now you've actually changed my mind on the subject, so well done on that, I thought that, you know, casuals or the mums out there or whatever would be intimidated to put on this headset, but I, you know, just because it seems a little bit too out there. But I hadn't really considered the fact that with VR, not every game is going to rely on you being a master of the button presses. It could be just something you experience by looking around. And looking around is something anyone can do. You know, just like when the Wii came out with our Wii Sports. That was, you know, a massive success because, yeah, anyone could pick a Wiimote and swing it like a tennis racket and there you go. And I guess with VR, anyone can turn their head and, you know, look around while they're in a virtual car race or roller coaster. So, yeah, that's a really good point. Please proceed if you have anything more to say. I just wanted to give credit where due, and I just thought that was a great point you made.
Oh, thank you. The other thing is that with the VR I've done, you've got little, not controllers, but little things in your hands that track your hand movement. And to activate it, all you literally have to do is move your hand and squeeze, essentially. And there's like a couple of buttons on it. It's essentially, you know, if they get it right, get it that immersive and get it that kind of intuitive, anyone can squeeze their hand or press a button or two. You know, that will draw in everyone.
Good point. Good. That's a solid argument. That is a very solid argument. And I don't know why, but I'm glad to hear that you're on board with this. Just because, you know, gaming can get a little bit mundane sometimes, and you can hear news on an upcoming console, and you're like, well, that's not too new or interesting, but I did have a feeling that the VR aspect may have caught your attention, and I am glad that they're following through with it, because I've heard very good things, like from you and from what I've read online, with VR, but at the moment, it's more of a, like, very advanced tech demos, you know? It's a good experience, but it isn't proper full-fledged games, whereas by the time the PlayStation 5 comes out, developers who were new to VR would actually have some experience, you know? Maybe it was too much asking them to, from the word go, bring out full-fledged VR games, and they need to get their toes wet in the kiddie pool before they jumped into the deep end.
And Capcom had good results with Resident Evil.
So. Yeah, they did. That's apparently the best VR experience to date in many people's many people's views. Jay, what do you think? PlayStation 5, yay or nay? Have we tempted you? Do you now have a sweet tooth?
Oh, yeah, look, I'm sold. I'll buy one. My mind, rightly or wrongly, also went straight to, I guess, like that business side of things where when you hear VR, you think, look, I hope for their sake that it is just inbuilt and then you buy a separate attachment to then operate it. That way the price is drilled down a little bit further so maybe everyone or more people can afford it. Maybe those who don't want VR can not, and then, yeah, obviously the ones who do can purchase it on top. And yeah,
like,
I mean,
like the goggles, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's, yeah. Yeah, so, and maybe they'll do bundles or whatever at the start, so it's a bit cheaper. But also, you know, just hearing the conversation between you two, straight away thought of, you know, those people who aren't maybe big gamers who would even use it, I guess, a bit like an avenue like The Sims, where you could just have a virtual world and you know, like the mums and dads or whatever that we were talking about before that might not want to play a Resident Evil game or a game that involves a lot of clicking and pressing, just pop the goggles on and you're in a virtual world and people just hanging out and talking and riding roller coasters or anything that doesn't require, you know, any effort really. And it's just a social thing, almost like apps or whatnot.
Or even education.
Yeah, education, massive, of course, yeah. That'd be phenomenal.
It's funny you mention that, actually, because quite a while ago, I saw this video which was just absolutely fascinating. It was when, you know, VR first, I believe it was when VR was still a Kickstarter project. I believe that's how it started, the Vive or whichever one it was. And they were showing concepts for it. And one concept, which I thought was really cool, is like right now we're talking on Skype. And they were basically showing what Skype or another chat program would be like with VR. And it showed people like literally sitting there talking to each other, looking at each other and speaking. And the environment could be anywhere. Like at one point they were just literally floating in space. The next second they were sitting in some sort of rainforest and they were just having a good old chat. And there are things which, you know, as far as a normal game goes, would sound a bit boring. It's like, oh, I got this game and you're sitting in the forest. You're like on wooden chairs. Like what? But you know, if we in the future, you know, like imagine in the future we can just like, yeah, you wanna talk, got a minute, all right, cool, we go into a virtual world and it's like, yeah, I feel like having a conversation, a volcano, why not?
Yeah.
And you just do it and you look at each other and the environments and yeah, not even game related, or hey, let's go on a holiday and let's go on a roller coaster. So has a lot of non-game implications, which just would be really fun.
Yeah, or imagine, I guess, even further, going for, I guess, a job interview and then pretty much virtually being able to walk you through, you know, whatever the workplace is or whatever the job is while you're sort of doing an interview over VR. That'd be phenomenal.
Wow.
I was just thinking that. Yeah. Like telecommunication. Yeah.
Yeah.
Possibilities are endless. Like the more you think about it, being able to be at home, but then VR puts you in another space that you're not actually in, and you can do that with others. Like anything is up for grabs, you know? As well as, which I've heard about in the movie industry, watching movies and actually not so much being part of it, but being able to control a free roaming camera in an actual movie. So it isn't 3D. It's like you've gone and you've seen the latest, I don't know, Godzilla movie or whatever. And yeah, you have the preset camera angle, but you know, you can look away. Like you can look and see what's around the corner and potentially discover extra details of a film which aren't available through the traditional methods.
I'm sorry. Just as you were saying that, I was just imagining in my head, like, Godzilla, like, just coming down right in front of you, just going like, brrr, in your face, and you just crap yourself. Or, like, in movies, like, a new form of Easter eggs is, like, you know, like, for example, you're watching some sort of zombie movie, and, like, you know, zombies are running past you to chase after the main characters, and then one of them sort of, like, looks at you and goes, like, brrr, and sticks his finger up at you and stuff like that.
Movie Easter eggs? That has to be a thing that happens.
Yep.
Like how cool would that be? Like, you watch a movie, it's fantastic, and then you read up online, and everyone's like, did you see the Mario Easter egg? And it's like, what? I didn't see Mario. And like, you just rewatch the movie again, and you're looking everywhere like a mad person. Like, you're never looking at the action. You're looking around every corner, and you're ignoring the movie until you see that Easter egg. Wow. Movies would actually have replayability. Like, yeah. You know, obviously they have it now, because if the movie's good, you'll watch it again. But imagine how much more invested you'll be is if you and your mates can watch the same movie and you just get different experiences. And it's like, wow, did you see that bit? It's like, no, well, you had to run down the waterfall and have a look. It's like, what waterfall? It's like, I was watching the movie with George. He went to the waterfall. Like this.
Of course he went to the waterfall.
It's just the thing he does.
George went to the fireplace every time.
Yeah. Oh god, the other thing I was thinking of, you distracted me with the waterfall talk. Ignore me for a second. I have to try to remember what I was thinking of.
Well, a certain friend of ours, George, actually works for, alongside the CFA or the Fire Authority here in Australia, and they had that at a recent conference where you could literally like strap on VR and go in as a firefighter approaching a bushfire as part of like their whatever, you know, their whatever business aspect it was, whatever their display was. So you could, yeah, pop it on and except obviously not feeling the extreme heat that they do, but yeah, get a bit more of an insight of to what they're facing when they're out there, which when he told me was just mind blowing.
You can buy like an electric heater, you know what I mean? Buy electric heaters and like blow warm air on people.
Or a lot of interns just blowing hot air and trying to and bring the temp up in the room.
like spraying people with water so they could simulate all the sweat they have on them.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they already do that. Like they call it 4D or something. They think there's actually a few. I think it was in China or Japan. It was one of those two countries, and I believe it was the latest. It was one of the Harry Potter movies, and during the scenes where you have the Deathly Hollows, you know, those bringers of death or whatever, like they even get near you and they suck away your happiness, and at the cinema they would they'd actually have machines that would lower the temperature or bring it down, so then it felt like, you know, it was actually happening. So if there was a cold ice scene or the characters jumped in cold water and they jumped down, they were shivering, I don't know if it was just the aircon would suddenly be really cranked up or something, but they would do something to just make it feel like you're in the same space as them.
Yeah, I've seen 4D movies. It's not that great yet. It's still emerging, but there are certain movies that it's good for, certain situations in movies that it's really immersive. And speaking of immersion, that's the thing I was thinking of. VR, you could lose your life to VR, man. I remember when I was doing it, I was visiting my brother's house and we were doing it, and I was like, I took my headset off at a certain point and I was like, oh man, you could so lose your life in here. It's like, have you guys seen Ready Player One?
No.
No, I really want to.
It's all right. I enjoyed it, but this whole Ready Player One thing is not going to hurt PlayStation at all. Because it's pretty fantastic, but it is a movie about people losing their lives to this stuff. So it's kind of one of those things where I reckon, parental controls on these things are going to have to be huge. Otherwise, you know, there are some kids who don't have a sense of, oh, hey, I have to go do the washing. Okay, just gonna,
I don't think any kids have that sense.
but kids won't have that, but an adult will be like, oh yeah, I've got to go pick up the kids.
Got to go to work.
Yeah. Have to go to parent-teacher interview night or whatever. But like, it's going to have to be something that they consider in their design, for sure.
That's very true. Like, I can picture, even normal gaming is very addictive, and there's adults out there that have actually been diagnosed with like being addicted to games and seeking professional help. And to be honest, even myself, like, I probably research games more than I actually play them, just because I'm fascinated with the industry. But, you know, if VR is done right and you can just escape to any world at any time and it feels like you're there, I would have to set myself a timer, because I would get too addicted. I'm like, right, I'm playing this for 2 hours, and then I need to go and adult. Because if I don't set that timer, I will just... I can see myself getting too addicted. Absolutely.
100%. 100%. And that's only going to make sales for Sony good.
Well, yeah, it would be a pretty good marketing thing. It's like, our VR is so addictive that... it's actually addictive. Like, doctors are diagnosing people, and there are clinics to slowly ward you off it and so forth. That's awesome. You should get addicted too. And then, like, a small disclaimer is like, please don't actually get addicted. Consult your doctor.
Sony's not responsible for all that.
Yeah, exactly. They're really fast talking at the end.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting, like, because, you know, like, right now when you talk about violence in video games, most of us scoff and go like, oh my god, you know, like, violence in video games isn't going to cause people to run out and do anything stupid. It's silly.
Yeah.
But in VR, that's going to be a whole other prospect, right? Because depending on how lifelike this stuff is, you never know. Because if something is that immersive, it feels like you're doing it, or you're in there, that could be this whole other thing. It would take doctors years to figure that out, too.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the ratings board would have to have a completely built from the ground up new rating system, because the impact would be stronger. Whether or not the impact does anything is, you know, like you said, it would take many years to figure out. But I think something which would just get a MA 15+ sticker just slapped on the game, that's it, move on. In VR, I reckon it'll probably be more of an 18+, because we don't quite know the effects. And, you know, adults can tell the difference, but, you know, a young kid playing this and actually looking at things, well, we don't actually want to turn them into murderers.
Yeah. Even like a 15-year-old, because, like, in Australia, the MA 15 plus is for, you know, 15 and over. Even some of that stuff might be, you know, might be considered too much, like you were saying. It's kind of philosophically interesting, isn't it? Because, like I was saying before, you know, to pick up something in VR, you generally squeeze something. That's pretty close. That's as close as you're going to get to buying a mannequin and, like, you know.
Well, if you're playing a shooting game, then, yeah, you know, squeezing the controller would feel like squeezing a trigger. So they would have to tread carefully. And how you even monitor that would be interesting. Like, you obviously can't see who's playing the game. You can choose who buys it, so who knows? Well, who knows? It's a it's an interesting article. But sorry, topic. But I will need to end things here. I would love to continue this on one of our future podcasts. Jay, thank you so much for joining us again. We haven't seen you in a while, and it's been great to have you back on board with us.
Thanks, boys. Thanks as always.
It's always good to see my oldest friend in the whole world.
I know, it's bad. We need that virtual world right now to be lounging around again, playing Street Fighter on the couch. We need it ASAP.